Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm joined today by Michelle Parchman. Michelle is originally a CPA and began her public accounting career in auditing with Anderson in Dallas. After 17 years in Big Four public accounting, plus 7 years with the largest executive search firm in San Antonio, she founded Parchman & Parchman Executive Search in 2009, specializing in accounting, finance, tax, legal, and C-level searches. Parchman & Parchman was named by Forbes as one of America's best recruiting firms, and Michelle has been described as one of San Antonio's most inspiring and influential women. She is also a board director for the Pinnacle Society, which is the premier consortium of 80 industry-leading recruiters in North America. Michelle, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Mark. Glad to be here.
Awesome. You referred to me by our mutual friend, John Schlegel. And how do you know John?
John and I are members of the Pinnacle Society, and I joined prior to his introduction to the society. And I think at the very first happy hour, we were sitting at a bar in the airport, and we were both watching the OU football game. And we discovered that we were both from Oklahoma, both small towns, and we loved Boomer Sooner football. And that's very rare to find somebody that likes an OU football team. So that's our connection.
Oh, fantastic. It's funny that you got to know each other in an airport. Have you heard of the LAX test?
Yes. So Tell me more.
Oh, well, just as a criteria for hiring someone, knowing whether you want them to join your firm, is if you were stuck in LAX with this person for an extended period of like hours and upon hours, would you be perfectly happy in their company for that, you know, that sort of duration? And if the answer is yes, then welcome on board. And if the answer is no, even if they're technically qualified for the job, then, you know, sorry.
You have the answer.
Exactly.
That's great.
So, oh, well, that's cool. I'm so glad that John put us in touch with each other. And tell me about your like transition from accounting to executive search. Why did you decide that this was the business for you?
Well, that is interesting. One thing that you probably didn't know, Mark, is the last probably 4 years of my career in public accounting, I had transitioned to a business development position outside of being a CPA. I still have my CPA license, and I did then. And I did that because at the time we had three young children and the hours were just terribly long in public accounting. And so I had gotten at least a taste of, you know, client service and business development and outside of just pure numbers. And so when Enron went down and Anderson was the auditor, and most people know that that's why Arthur Anderson was indicted by the DOJ. And I guess we lost 88,000 employees in 354 countries in the year 2002. So we all lost our jobs that year. I was obviously going to make a transition. And so I was going to stay in public accounting. And I had two offers. And a wonderful woman that was on a board with me at the Junior League of San Antonio was listening to my offers. And she was a recruiter. And so she learned everything that was important to me and how I was going to make this decision. And she owned an executive search firm in town. And so she said, let's go to breakfast tomorrow morning. And we did. And she said, I'd like to throw out a third offer. And she said, why don't you come to my firm and build an accounting, tax, and legal function? Because we don't have that. They didn't do that type of recruiting. And ultimately, I made the decision because it was more of an 8-to-5 job. Honestly, it was like 6 miles from our elementary school. And it just seemed to me like the right time in my career to pivot and do something very different.
Wow, that's so cool. I'm glad that you shared that with me. And coincidentally, I've got three kids as well. And it is, wow, it is busy. And so one of the things I'd love to talk to you later about is balance. Because you told me, you shared with me offline that you're a master in a balanced life. I want to know more about what that means. But so you pivoted from accounting to public accounting to executive search. And how did things go from there?
Well, I would say probably the first 90 days. Now, think about this is 2002-2003 timeframe, and I had no experience in recruiting. And so I would say my first 90 to 120 days, I thought I had made the biggest mistake in my entire life. You know, they literally wanted me to open up a yellow pages, you know, white pages, and just start calling companies and trying to introduce myself as an accounting recruiter. And I didn't know any of the terminology. As a matter of fact, the reason I'm in Pinnacle is because 3 weeks into becoming a recruiter, the National Association of our personnel consultants annual conference was in San Antonio, and I went, and they were using all these terminologies like JOs for job orders and SOs for send outs. And I left there thinking, this makes no sense. It's not a job order. It's a job. And it's not a send out, it's an interview. And I'm thinking, I'm going to change all the terminology. So I didn't like anything about the position in the beginning. And I thought it lacked process, and I thought it lacked systems. And it was just picking up the phone and smiling and dialing. And I thought, I will never succeed in something like this. I'm too analytical and I'm too process oriented. And so I decided to roll up my sleeves and just ask permission to do things my way. And I did. And that is really, you know, I would say my journey. It was very challenging the first 6 months. I did not think I was going to like it. I didn't think I was going to succeed. But once I was able to kind of roll up my sleeves and lay out, you know, processes, and this is how we're going to strategize to get new clients, and this is how we're going to serve them, and these are the steps that we're going to follow. Once I put that together and I built it, and I had a team by that time. I think I had hired 4 or 5 people. It was great, but beginning was rough.
Wow, that's such a great story. Thank you. I also did not enjoy recruiting when I first started, and it was similar, like thrown into the deep end, and literally like, yeah, here's a phone, here's a computer, go and make cold calls and find, you know, jobs to work on and so on. And I thought, what have I gotten into here? This is different to what I expected. So you mentioned that first sort of 6 months, which was really tough. What was going through your mind, like coming into work every day and feeling so out of your depth?
You know, I think I typically persevere, and I want to succeed, and I'm motivated. And so I just was not willing to not let this work. And I love the idea of it. But then I started finding that we sort of had a bad reputation in a way. I mean, some people didn't think that recruiters were the most savvy, perhaps, or the most professional. I thought, well, I'd love to change that. I mean, that would be something that would be fantastic. And you know what I discovered, Mark? And I think most people get there. I just didn't know this in the beginning. What I found is I was trying to sell my firm, and they'd never done accounting or tax. And so I just hit roadblock after roadblock because they didn't even think we had the capability. And I later realized that it was easier to sell myself. It was much easier to say, my name is Michelle Parchman, and I'm a CPA, and I spent 17 years in public accounting. And I have this absolutely amazing audit manager from PwC. And that was easy. I mean, that was like a no-brainer for me because that's what I knew. That was my background. That's what I lived, and that's where I came from. And then all of a sudden, potential clients, they could understand that I knew what I was talking about. And I wasn't really selling necessarily the firm or really me. It was, I knew the person that I was representing was a great, highly talented, credentialed person. And so I think that was kind of, it sounds so basic, but that was that first transition of a aha. I think I kind of figured out how to recruit. And again, it was quite basic.
Amazing. No, that's, I can see that being a light bulb moment and realizing your background was made you very credible. And clients could understand that you knew what a good person, you know, what a good profile was, and you'd be able to tell the difference and that sort of thing. So it's, yeah, absolutely brilliant. You said you're very process driven, and until you had to redesign the job to fit for you, what were some of those other changes that you made in order to make it work?
Well, you know, having been in public accounting for as long as I was, you know, the training and development in Big Four is just unreal. You know, you're constantly learning new software, new processes, best practices. The first best practice I ever learned to me that was so real and impactful is Arthur Anderson did a study on Southwest Airlines was our client. And we wanted to figure out how we could refuel the planes faster. Because the faster you can refuel, the faster you can get a plane off the ground back in the air, which means more revenues because you're having more flights. So we basically said, who is the fastest fueling type of thing in the world? And it was the Indy 500, you know, race cars. They refuel as fast. And so we studied how they refuel fast. I mean, how they do it faster. And so we replicated or transitioned that type of idea into from a car, a race car to a plane. And so to me, as simple as that sounds, and that's always been my philosophy is keep it simple. It made so much sense. And so I always make everything as simple as I can. And so to answer your question, I take that philosophy and I say, okay, how can we put in templates or how can we put in the first three or four or five steps that are the same thing, repeatable every time, but they're proven and they work. And that's really what I do. And so, you know, I have a whole like what I do every day, my top 10 things, and I can go through all those, but probably not necessary, but that's basically what I do. So it's replicating proven simple steps.
Love it. That sounds great. Now, I would love to know your top 10 things. In fact, you gave me something very tantalizing in your notes that you put. By the way, I believe that you're very process-driven because you are one of the most organized guests I've ever had on the show. The preparation was on par, or on point, I should say. How to bill $500,000 and work less than 15 hours a week. That seems impossible. Tell me how one can accomplish that, Michelle.
It is 100% possible. And I have been doing it for years and years. And it is because I look at everything as ROI. So every single thing I do, I think in my head, what is the return on my investment? And it, and for me, it's time for then money. And so I try to make sure that everything I do is going to take me the least amount of time and give me the highest amount of money. And so an example would be if I have a strategic plan of the 10 best steps that I do in every job order when I get it from a client, and I'm going to try to find the best candidate for them, I am absolutely going to do my first and second step first that take me hardly any time at all. Like, let's say 15, 20, 30 minutes or an hour. The last thing I want to do is step 10, which takes forever, which is creating an e-blast and reaching out to 500 people and putting together all these materials. And I don't really post, but do those things. So I'm going to always do steps 1 and 2 instantly and first. And I do my entire day that way. You know, I look at the top 10 things I have to do. I keep in mind every day what is closest to the money, what is most important. And I do those things first. I don't do the easiest, fastest things necessarily if they're not most important and most efficient and don't have a return on my investment. They get pushed down to number 9 and 10 every day. So that's just, and I run my life that way.
Amazing. Tell me more about this. So, the concept of thinking about the ROI, not just for money, but for your time is absolutely makes total sense. Working closest to the money. I understand what that means, but can you explain it in case people haven't heard that expression before?
Absolutely. So a pretty simple example would be, let's say this morning I woke up and I had two emails from clients. One client is a very large Fortune 50 company, and they have, you know, HR in process, and it takes me 6 weeks to make a placement. But they're a great company, and people want to work there, and my candidates would want to know that that is an open position because they're highly reputable and recognized. And then my second client calls, and they want to give me a three-week exclusive, and it's a third fee. And it is in my wheelhouse, meaning it's a candidate that I probably can make 20 phone calls and find. So in that situation, I would invest all of my 2 hours that particular day if I'm working on that exclusive that's for 3 weeks that's in my wheelhouse. So that would be a return on my investment because I can probably make that placement in a week or two. Whereas the other Fortune 50 company, which is great, and I want to work that search and I want to share with my network that I'm working that search, but the chances of me placing that and or placing that in 6 weeks is much lower. So it, again, it's all about analysis of fastest and closest to the money.
Beautiful. I love this. This is cool. You mentioned 10 things you do each day. Could you talk me through those?
You know, it's funny. People ask me that all the time because I think of myself, you know, we all self-reflect and we're good at some things and not so good at others. And I am a good planner. I think that's where I strive, and I'm best in the morning. I'm most creative in the morning. And so, you know, I would have to say, Mark, it's not necessarily the exact same 10 things every day. But what it is coming up with what 10 things are most important for me to do today. And then what I try to do within those 10, because if I'm only going to work 2 or 3 hours that day, I may not be able to do all 10. But by golly, I will make sure I do the most important 5 things first. And again, it gets back to return on my investment, and it gets back to, because I have such limited time, I can't waste time. I mean, there is no opportunity for me to waste time. It's the same when I work out or I exercise. I don't have time to go spend 4 hours and play golf, even though I would love to do that. I'm going to go to a HIIT class and do high intensity in 30 minutes because I'm going to get the best bang for my buck. Now, am I sometimes going to go enjoy golf and spend 5 hours on a Saturday? Yes. But again, I just look at everything analytically and efficiency. And my nickname, Mark, I should share with you, when I was at Arthur Anderson, you know, ASAP, the acronym ASAP. Well, they called me ASP, ASAP for short, because I wanted everything to be done as soon as possible. That was just my, I have a high energy, and it was just a funny little nickname that they gave to me.
Fantastic. So I'm just trying to understand, by the way, why are you only working 2 or 3 hours a day?
Because I want to.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Well,
but why do you want to? Like what, how did this, because it's, most people just assume it's a 40-hour week minimum, and then a lot of recruiters are working 50, 60, 70 hours. So, and they don't really question that. So what caused this? Do you even think, well, I could be doing the same results in half the time?
It started in 2003 when we had 3 young children. And so I always wanted to be home when the bus got home. And so our youngest went to a private school, and so we had to pick him up at 1. So it started when, you know, I felt like I needed to be home at 1, and then the 2 older children got home at 2. And so I always wanted to be a mom first. And I really do want to talk about something that's really important to me too, Mark, and we can get to that next. And that is, I believe you have to know your values. And mm-hmm. I stress this with people on a team that I've managed. I stress this with employees. I stress this with candidates and clients. You have to know your values first. And if you know where your values are, then you can set all your priorities around those values to achieve them. And so for me, to answer your question, my value was always first was my family and my children and my husband. And second was my career. And I realize other people have different values. I mean, they have, you know, church, or they have, you know, health, or a charity as a passion. Their career could be their passion, business, an elderly parent. You know, everybody has different values. But then once you know what your values are and you know those, the order of those values, then you set your entire day and your life around those. That's how you set your priorities. So that's how it initially started. But the 2 to 3 hours came when, even as my children started getting a little older, we started spending more time in the summers vacationing. And so I wanted more time away to spend with them when they were not in school. And so again, that was the push. But what I have found is that there are people, and there are recruiters, and recruiters that I know very well, that are wildly successful. And they work 80 hours a week, and they grind it, and they produce about the same that I do in a 15 to 20 hour week. And what I realized is it's kind of that 80-20 rule. They're spending an extra 80% of their time to perhaps bill an extra 50. And I'm not willing to do that. And so part of it is too, it's a challenge. It's a challenge to prove that I can adapt and adopt my policies and best practices and ROI procedures to a 2 to 3 hour workday. And it works, and it does. But everybody is successful in different ways.
It's incredible. I love this philosophy. And it's quite revolutionary. Like, I'm blown away, Michelle, by what you're sharing. I did a poll on LinkedIn recently to find out what fee percentage recruiters charge, and it confirmed what I'd learned from speaking with so many recruiters every day. The majority of recruiters are undervaluing their service and cutting their fees to become more competitive. Listen, if you want to protect your cash flow and build reserves to protect your business against whatever might happen in the future, you need to be earning more for each placement, not less. The challenge, of course, is how to increase your fees and still be competitive. iIntro has helped hundreds of recruiters to make small but critical adjustments to the way they pitch and win business so they can win more clients who are also willing to pay higher fees. For example, one of their clients typically earned £5,000 per placement. But just a few weeks after working with iIntro, she won a new piece of business on a retainer. So in other words, she got a deposit and her fee was an incredible £20,000, four times her average. If you'd like to see how iIntro can help you to grow your recruitment business and increase your average fees, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained and book a free consultation. There's no obligation. And if you mention that you're a listener of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, iIntro have pledged to offer you a 25% discount off any of their services. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained to get started. You've taken this thinking of being more efficient and prioritizing effectively, and you've taken it to another level. Have you heard of Parkinson's Law? The work expands to, you know, fill the time that you have available.
Yes.
I think I'm guilty of that is, you know, however long I have, that's how long the job ends up taking. Mm-hmm. So I'm inspired. I'm going to be starting to adopt some of your ideas here myself. So coming back to the planning then, does this happen the night before? Does this happen like first thing? When do you do your planning and prioritization?
Well, you will love this because this probably sounds diabolically different from everything that I've said. My brain never shuts off. So from a creative perspective, which to me is part of my planning, it never stops. And I know that there are a lot of wonderful recommendations on, you know, you plan at the end of your day, you know, right before you leave work, you know, maybe from 4 to 5, or you plan first thing in the morning, or you plan whenever it's best for you. I never stop planning. I mean, it can be 4 in the morning and I will send myself a text to remind if I think of something really creative. It can be 8 o'clock at night and I'm at dinner or happy hour and I think, oh my goodness, I need to call Mark. I will send so my planning never stops, but it's because my brain never stops actively thinking about ideas. I'm just an idea generator, and that means nothing if you don't execute on it. And so if I don't write it down, I'm a to-do person. So if it's not written down, it probably won't happen. And that's basically the way I plan.
Love it. Okay. That's cool. So physically, I'm getting really nitty gritty here because I so much want to learn from you, Michelle. What form does your to-do list take? Is it electronic? Is it pad and paper? Like, or do you have a planning, like one of those hardbound planners? What do you use to capture those ideas and then prioritize them?
I have an old-fashioned leather-bound book that has, you know, children. How old are your children, Mark?
They are 17, 13, and 11.
Okay, so maybe your 11-year-old wouldn't do it anymore. But in the olden days, we had like three-ring paper.
Yeah,
and
it
was like college-ruled paper. Okay, so my leather-bound book still uses college-ruled paper, and I love it because I can write a whole lot on one page before I flip to the next page and I write small. So it is not electronic. I still handwrite all my to-dos. My children think I'm so old fashioned, but it works for me.
Absolutely. Fair enough. That sounds great. So then to talk me through your thought process, then you've got a list of lots of things you could do. You know, I need to call Mark. I need to do this. I need to do that. And then you probably have more than 10 things though, right? So how do you distill it down to the most important things that you need to accomplish that day?
People ask me that a lot. And to me, it is so easy. That is the easiest thing to do every day is if you look at your list, and I can look at it 10 times, I know I can pick out of those 10 things, which number 2, number 4, or number 8, what has to get done right now. To me, it's just so easy. It's like, how do you prioritize? How do you know which things are most important? Well, you do. And yes, you're going to get interrupted and, you know, and your son may call you and say, Mom, I just got a speeding ticket or I need to do this or how do I do that? And yes, that takes you away and that becomes the most important thing. But to me, it's just, it's a matter of sense. It's very basic.
Fair enough. Well, you've told me two guiding principles. One is your values. So that's going to have an influence. And then the other is where are you going to get the best ROI, return on effort? And so if you're using those as your filter, then that can help you to shuffle and prioritize those things. So that's fantastic. And then, I mean, do you ever have to work a full day or is 2 or 3 hours what you're aiming for? Or is that really what you do on a typical day?
So a typical day for me is I start early and I'm best from about 7 a.m. until about 9. And that's when I accomplished most that I'm going to get done during the entire day. And then I have gym buddies. And so I have these workout groups and we go every single day, Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 11-ish. And then I really usually kind of hang out with girlfriends and have fun, or we may play pickleball or tennis. And then in the afternoon, and I almost always make phone calls around the lunch hour because that's when a lot of people can talk, right? That's the only time they have to talk, whether it's a client or a candidate, they kind of still have the old fashioned lunch hour. And then I pick back up and I might work an hour in the afternoon between about 5 and 6, because again, that's when my clients and candidates are available to talk to me. So I would say it's kind of about a 3 hour, perhaps, work day. Yes, I sometimes have to work a full day. I mean, I might have a really harder search than I'm used to having, or it may be a little bit outside my wheelhouse, but it's very important to my client that I perform and that I find them talent. And so I might have to try avenues that I normally don't have to try. And yes, I would absolutely work an 8 hour, but I probably didn't work the week before. I might've been on vacation. So I would still tell you my average is 2 to 3 hours a day year round. And I take most summers off completely.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So then what happens during the summers if you have, you know, clients who have requirements and they're like, hey, Michelle, can you fill this job for us?
Well, I'm fortunately, and I don't know why this is, and it seems to have been fairly cyclical. In the summer, in my accounting space in San Antonio, it's fairly slow. And I just don't know if it's the San Antonio mentality and most everybody is in and out on vacation. Yes, I mean, I have positions right now that I'm working on. I don't have a lot of positions in the summer, but I will work a little bit, but it's really not a lot.
Awesome. Have you got a support team either in San Antonio or even offshore? Do you have other people you can delegate things to?
You know, I have not gone that route. And part of it is I don't want to have to manage anyone. And I mean that literally, like in any way, not even an admin. I don't want to have to manage because I don't want to keep somebody else busy, like another recruiter. So no, I'm just a solopreneur and it seems to have always worked that way. And, you know, I have to tell you, Mark, I admire in Pinnacle Society, for example, we have just the most, I mean, it's just a powerhouse of recruiters sitting around a table, 80 people. And I listen to some of these high producers. They have every software tool that is available to mankind. They do robocalling and they download every single contact piece of information. And I mean, it just blows me away. And they have the applicant tracking systems and, you know, they have teams of 20. And I just don't. I mean, I don't even have an applicant tracking system. I still use Outlook for my contacts. I still save resumes in my, you know, Word and PDF folder on my computer. I know it sounds so old fashioned, but I think the most important thing to take away is, yes, it may seem old school, but it works. And I modify, you know, I change things. I do upgrade. But at the end of the day, and I think I might have put these in my notes, I believe that my network is my bank account. And I spent 17 years at Arthur Andersen. And when we all left, we all lost our jobs. We were all displaced. Everybody had to go somewhere. And they have all become my clients and my candidates. probably 80% of my network for many, 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 many years has been CPAs that are CEOs, that are CFOs, that have taken companies public, that now run, you know, some of the biggest, you know, Fortune 100 companies, and they are highly ethical. You know, they're credentialed, and they all also had best practices having been grown up at Arthur Anderson. And so I feel like that's why when somebody refers a candidate to me, they're good, because they're coming from somebody that's great.
Great people know great people. I've definitely found that to be the case. And like meeting you is an example. You know, John was awesome. He referred you. It's definitely true. So tell me more about your network being your bank account. Can you elaborate on that?
I'd be happy to. I just feel blessed in the sense that I know really smart people, and ethics are very important to me. And I feel like CPAs alone, I put that in a category because, you know, you do have to be certified. You do have to be educated. You have to keep up with training and have 120 hours of educational training with the latest regulations and things. You know, every 3 years you have to have 120 hours. And just in general, CFOs, which is the space that I place in, are structured, and they follow policy and they follow procedures, and they're ethical. And I think because those type of people are my network. Mm-hmm. I just feel that when they refer candidates to me or they're a client of mine, they make me proud because I know that person is credentialed and they're coming with a thumbs up from somebody that I really trust. So that's mm-hmm. when I refer to them being my bank account, is because they're so trusted and they're known and the eyes are on them. You know, it's not just like it's any person at a company. I mean, these are people that are being evaluated by the government and regulatory bodies and things like that. And so that's why I think my network is so strong.
Amazing. So when you talk about your network, because most recruiters, I think their network would be their database, their ATS, or their LinkedIn network, but you're not using an ATS. So when you talk about your network, are these just people you know personally through relationships you developed over time? Or how do you define or quantify that network?
Exactly. So you're right. I don't use LinkedIn as a network. I mean, I post things, and that's really more for just getting the word out there. It's not because I'm expecting to get somebody, you know, connecting with me on LinkedIn. It's people, it's real relationships. I am a relationship builder, period. I mean, that is my motto in anything and everything I do. It's about building a relationship, and it has to be trusted, and we have to be partners, and we have to be open and transparent in all of our communication. And so my network, it's people that I do know. And again, I get introduced to new people. Mm-hmm. So my network is constantly expanding, which is fantastic. But yes, it's people. It's not a thing or a database or
But then how do you track all of these people that you know just with the contacts and Outlook?
It works. It works beautifully. Okay. Well, and then also I'm going to make this really easy for you to understand.
All right.
Let's say you and I get connected, which we did. Mm-hmm. And the best way that I ever think I'll remember your name. Let's say you have the craziest last name that I can't even spell. If I write in my Outlook contact, John Schlegel introduced me to him, and then maybe, you know, Resilient Recruiter or something, or Podcast 2021, I just put in those few things. I promise you, Mark, 7 years from now, I can find you just by going into my phone and saying Schlegel. I mean, you're going to pop up just by saying, and so I just put in little, you know, notes like that. And that's all it takes for me to always be able to go back to that person to find them. And so, I told you, I keep it simple. It doesn't get any simpler than my life.
Amazing. I'm buying into this for sure. So coming back to the heading of how to bill $500,000 and work less than 15 hours a week, are there any other, before we move on to like, you know, balance and things like that, like any other advice or strategies in connection with being super efficient?
You know, I'll probably just recap in saying, you know, once you figure out, you streamline things and you know how something is a best practice, just making sure you replicate that. I'm efficient in everything I do. I would never recreate something. I mean, once I do it once, if it's solid, I'm going to keep doing it every single time. I'm very good with follow-up, very good. I'm very thorough. I'm very detail-oriented. And I know some recruiters aren't necessarily detail-oriented or aren't as analytical as I am. And it seems maybe a little bit out of score because, you know, we're kind of salespeople in many ways and relationship people. But I think that has set me apart in some ways is that detail orientation and just following, you know, constant best practices. And I revise them all the time. So I self-reflect and I certainly make errors and I do things that are not the best. And I'll be the first one to say, I'll never do it that way again. And what is a better way to do it? And so I guess that would probably be it, that in a summary.
Michelle, my colleague, Leanne Sir Jones Hunt, is going to love this episode. She is like, you guys are peas in a pod. I hired her because you're like, what you're describing, I love intellectually. It's so different to me and the way I work. I aspire to be more like you, but Leanne is, you know, would you guys would be singing from the same hymn sheet for sure.
Well, you're going to have to connect us. I'd love to talk to her.
I will. Okay. Definitely. So best practices. What's your definition of a best practice? Like, and do you document these or how do you, you know, or is it just something you keep in mind?
No, they're very well documented. So an example would be, and this is different. Some people I actually have had so much resistance in doing this when I manage teams, mm-hmm. but because I am detailed, an example, mm-hmm. I will take a resume and when I vet, I think as hard as the client, and probably 80% of people might not even get past me because I'm so detailed in the way that I vet. I look for red flags. And if there's any concern at all, I'm not moving forward. I mean, I'm not taking on risk. And that's why I've never had somebody that hasn't worked out in 17 years, because I am going to make sure that this person is 100%, you know, who they are and high character. So I have what's called a credential summary, and it's basically my interview notes, but it's in different categories and my clients love them so much because they're so detailed. And again, I'm serving CFOs and they're detailed and they're CPAs. And so they love more information, more notes, but it has everything you can ever imagine. So what is their personality profile? Their comp package in detail. I mean, this is their base. This is their bonus. This is their 401k. This is their equity. This is their next raise. This is what they're looking for. This is what's important. And then, one of the most important questions I think I ask every single person and I ask of myself all the time is what is really most important to you? Most important to you in a job, a company, a client, in your life, in your family. And my clients love that section because then they know, is it going to be aligned with what they're looking for or aligned with their company mission? But what is most important to you? And it changes in life. I mean, if you ask me, Mark, what was most important to me in 2002, it's different, not entirely, but it's different than what's most important to me in 2021. And that question, it's so fascinating too. When I interview a candidate, you know, 10 years ago, and I ask them that question, and then 10 years later, you know, their position's getting eliminated or they're looking for a new role. And I go back and say, what's most important to you now? It's wonderful to do a comparison based on life events and other things that have changed. But so my credential summary is very, very detailed. My clients love it. The first thing they'll ask for is, I got the resume, but where's the credential summary? But normally I send them together. But that is an example of a best practice. My clients love it. HR never even looks at it. I mean, it's just like way too much information for them. Plus HR thinks that's their job. And, you know, and it's also my point of view. I'm the one that's interviewing them and creating the summary, and HR wants to do their own thing, which I highly recognize and respect. And then I have another one that, the company that does my e-blast, it's just a kind of a standard form. I guess I think probably everybody would have that, but mine is something that is quite standard. Anyway, I just have lots of examples of best practices that I do. I just try not to recreate anything. So once it's really great, it becomes a template.
Brilliant. Love it. And Do you know what? This is very relevant to a discussion that I'm having in one of my coaching groups at the moment, which is on creating systems, processes, standard operating procedures for your business so that you're not reinventing the wheel all the time and things run like a well-oiled machine. And your best practices would fit right in with that. Something you said, one of the sections on your candidate report, what did you call it?
Credential summary.
There you go. Yeah. What's most important to you? It reminded me of the first time I learned about values was when I was about 16. I listened to Tony Robbins' Personal Power audio tapes, and he talks about values and making sure that you A, know what your values are, B, that they're serving you and they're not, you know, in conflict with what you're trying to accomplish. But the question for determining your or someone else's values is to ask what's most important to you. Mm-hmm. And that was the formula to elicit someone's values. And you've tapped into that. But I never thought of using it in this way to get to know your candidates better.
It's really, it's very valuable, I have found. And my clients absolutely love that particular section. And sometimes I have to dig a little further, you know, so you'll ask the question, you know, Charlie, really, what is most important to you? And sometimes they'll just say one thing. And, you know, career advancement, for example, is quite common. And then I'll say, what else? And then they'll say something. And then I'll say, what else? And then they'll say something else. And then they'll say, well, you know what? The most important thing is, and it blows me away because I'm thinking, so the most important three things they just said were not the most important. It takes kind of a conversation to get you there to then find out that location's the most important thing. And you're like, holy moly, you're kidding me. Location's the most important. You know, where you work is the most important. So again, it gets back to just asking, you know, basic questions.
That's a beautiful little nugget there, which is subtle, but so important, is never accept someone's first answer, keep digging. And by asking what else and what else and what else, you're just uncovering so much more information. The other follow-up though is someone might say career advancement, but what does career advancement mean to them? That might be something totally different to what career advancement means to someone else. So sometimes you need to follow up and just get their definition of what would represent, you know, a really exciting career advancement for them. Great. Let's talk about, you mentioned something to me. I am a master in a balanced life. What do you mean by that?
That's probably a bold statement. But I say that, Mark, because I really feel like I have been successful working 2 to 3 hours a day and spending more time on family, vacation, health, and exercise than I do working. And so And I think it all goes back to, you know, we are in control of what's most important to us and what our values are. We really are. We are in control of that for the most part. And I wanted to share an example with you. When I was in public accounting, I would have women, mostly working moms, come to me all the time, and they would be in tears. And they would be saying, Michelle, I get up at 4:30 in the morning and I get interrupted even trying to, you know, work out. And then I'm making, you know, breakfast for my children and they're screaming on the way to work. And then I'm running out of gas and I'm late to my first meeting. And then I have this and then I have that. And then I get called out and then I get home and, you know, I'm getting my kids in bed and I'm falling asleep and I'm back online and I'm emailing clients and they're complaining basically about they're working 16 hours a day and they're not seeing their family. And so then I would say to them, okay, well, you know, you're on the top engagement at the firm. Like, it's the most prestigious client in the world. And the reason you're moving and working these hours is because they're doing M&A and you have to follow that. And that might be in London. And so I said, what is most important to you? And they will say, oh, my children, you know, I'm missing my children. I don't get to see their soccer games. I'm not, you know, getting to put them in bed. And I said, okay, well, so we're gonna have to look at, we're gonna have to change some things. So you might have to go on to a mid-market client in San Antonio. You're not going to be on the top client. Well, then what would ultimately happen, and this is just one example, they would come back to me and say, I'm not giving up X client because it is, I mean, that's their worth, and that's where they're learning, and that's their career, and that's their footprint on their resume. And so we would all come back to, okay, what is most important? Is it most important that you're working these hours and you're on this client, or is it most important that you're a mom and your kids are first? And it's their decision, and they get to decide those things. And so it all, again, comes back to the balance. Where do you want the balance? You really are in control of that. Now, the other person might say, I'm willing to get off that prestigious client for 2 or 3 years because it really is more important for me to be home and tuck my kids in bed. But those are just two examples that it really does get down to. If you want to be the master of balance, you have to be also willing to make those hard and tough decisions that then allow you to create the right balance that you really want. And so it gets back to, what do you really want?
Absolutely. That's brilliant. I love that, Michelle, because I heard once, and I think this is accurate, you can have anything you want in life, but you can't have everything you want. Mm-hmm. So at least not at the same time, right? Because going after one thing precludes you automatically from going out after something else that's over here, right? You have to make those decisions that take you towards that thing that's most important to you, and maybe means that you you let go of other things which are less important. So that is amazing. Was this a process? Like, how did you transition from working, say, a normal, like when you're a CPA and you're working, you know, long hours, especially in busy season, or maybe even starting a new job as a recruiter and you're learning the ropes? At what point did you make this transition, and how long did it take for you to sort of reorganize yourself to work fewer hours?
That is a great question, Mark. You know, I look back when I started in public accounting, I was single. Mm-hmm. I worked 800 hours of overtime my first 1 or 2 years. It was insane, the number of hours I worked, but I could. I mean, I didn't have any other responsibilities. You know, I was not married, again, didn't have children. And then when we moved to San Antonio and then we started a family, those hours got a lot harder to do. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we had our third baby, it was like, okay, you know, our priority shifted. You know, as I said before, you know, what becomes most important to you changes in time. And so it was literally a decision that my family is more important than anything else, and that moves to number one. And when that happened, work moved to number two. And it was a decision that I had to be home at 1 o'clock every day. That was the deal. Either I was going to stay working for that recruiting firm and they were going to allow that, or I was going to go out on my own. And so they allowed me to do that. So it was kind of just a draw line in the sand. And so then your question is, okay, how did you then make that transition? It's just driving that efficiency, and it's driving that ROI, return on effort. I mean, it is constant in my brain. I mean, if I have three calls to make, I'm going to make the one that is the most critical first before I make number two and three. It's just the way my brain functions.
I understand that, and that makes total sense. I guess what I'm getting at is, if someone wanted to emulate what you've done, Michelle, you know, would it be a case of saying, okay, as of Monday, I'm working, you know, 4 hours a day instead of 8 hours a day, and that's all the time available, so I have to just make that work? Or is it a case of, okay, over time, I'm going to increase my efficiency and reduce the number of hours I'm working? So like, you know, next week, I'm going to make sure I only work my 40 hours and I'll just be much more good at planning. And then maybe next month, I'll get it down to 30 hours. Do you see what I mean? Like,
absolutely,
is it a gradual, is it a gradual thing, or is it just a decision? Like, nope, it's 3 hours a day from now on. That's it.
I'll answer it this way. For me, it was draw a line in the sand saying, I'm going to stop working at 1 o'clock every day. So that, and I did that, and I did it successfully. I'm not saying it was the easiest transition, but yes, I did it. I have absolutely witnessed in Pinnacle, and I've taught some of what I do, my efficiencies and working less hours. And I have seen other Pinnacle members transition, and they've done what you've done or mentioned. The second is the option of kind of gradually saying, well, I'm going to stop working at four now instead of working till 7 or 8, or I'm going to, you know what I mean? And they've been successful doing that too. So what I would say is, I think either will work. The key is going to be building in efficiencies that make you successful doing it. Because if you're not efficient at it, it's not going to work. I mean, you're not going to be able to bill at the same level and support your clients at that level if you are not efficient in what you do.
Amazing. Now, one of the things that makes you efficient is only working on jobs you're going to actually fill and make money from, right? And so you've mentioned a few times that you work exclusively. How did you come to that sort of philosophy of, you know, you're only going to work with clients exclusively, for example?
Initially, it started, when I left the firm that I was with, I had signed a 2-year non-compete, which is a long time, but I also signed the agreement. And so I was absolutely going to adhere to that. And I also thought, okay, it'll give me a couple of years to be with my kids. And so what happened, I had clients that started coming to me during the non-compete, like towards the end of it. They started coming to me and they basically said, Michelle, we've got to have you work on these positions. And by the way, that was within my agreement because technically I wasn't soliciting them. They were coming to me. And so I just said, you know, I would only feel comfortable working on this if I had an exclusive, because then I would know for sure there was no way I could be having a competitive situation. And that way I felt a little bit better about it. So that's how it initially started. Well, then it kind of, the bells even, you know, started ringing. I thought, well, this is really, really smart. And so I started asking for exclusives as often as I can. And believe it or not, I get them a lot. I mean, I'm still surprised that I get so many exclusives, and I only do a 3-week period because, again, we've talked about my network. My network is not indefinite. It is not gigantic. It is not like many people's. Mine is definite. It's defined. It's a defined market. Mm-hmm. Typically, if I don't get a referral through my network within the first 2 to 3 weeks, I am not going to be successful for my client. Mm-hmm. And so that 3-week period makes sense to me, and it makes sense to my client. And I'm also very transparent. Once I get to that 2-week, 3-week period, if I haven't found somebody or if I'm feeling like I'm not going to, I let my client know. I immediately will say, it is now time for you to use other recruiters because I'm not going to be your best resource. And they appreciate that. I don't mind competition ever. It's just, I like having the 3-week exclusive first.
So tell me, Michelle, why wouldn't you just insist on only working with clients exclusively?
Great question. Because I could probably name 10 or 15 like that. Great companies in San Antonio that would never do an exclusive because their corporate policy wouldn't allow that. And I still want them as clients. And I still have candidates that would want to work there.
Makes sense. Fantastic. Michelle, I could keep talking to you for hours, but I'm conscious I've taken the equivalent of about a half a working day here already for you.
I know, I got to go. I got to go to the gym.
Great. I'm glad to hear it. So thank you so much. It's been fantastic and illuminating. And I've actually decided myself, I need to relook at my values because I've not looked at that for a while and reprioritize my time to see how I can shave the hours down because they are creeping up. I missed lunch today. I was just telling you because I just worked straight through lunch. So that's not ideal. Michelle, thanks again. And I hope we get a chance to talk again in the future.
Absolutely. It's been such a pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you.